Welcome to the Geological Society podcast. My name's Sarah Day, and I'm with our Shell lecturer for this month, Professor Sanjeev Gupta, who is a Professor of Earth Science at Imperial College and a member of the science project team for Curiosity Rover. Sanjeev, you gave an amazing talk today about what Curiosity's been up to. It's been up there for about just over a year now, I believe. What's it been doing since it got there?
Oh, amazing things, actually. We had this extraordinary landing on the surface of Mars, and then we could get on with the science. And so we basically, it's exploration. We don't know what's there. We have some idea from orbital images. We make predictions. And then we start, what we do is we look at images. We take images, we take photographs of the landscape. We look for rock outcrops. In particular, we're looking for sedimentary rocks. So we're looking for layering. So we'll look in the distance, and if we see an interesting sedimentary rock layer, we'll target towards that. We've identified these features on images, satellite pictures. And so it's all about exploration and discovering new things.
There's a lot of talk about how our understanding of Earth can help with this research on Mars and how we can understand Mars as a sort of analogue. Is any of what Curiosity is doing going to help us understand more about Earth's history?
In fact, actually, that's the reason to go to Mars. So what's interesting is that Mars preserves a rock record likely much older than Earth. Earth has a plate tectonic cycle, so rocks obviously get recycled. Mars doesn't have a plate tectonic cycle, so it probably preserves rocks that are extremely old that we don't find on Earth. So one of the reasons to go to Mars is to try and understand early planetary formation, the early stages that we don't have a record for on Earth. And so that will be really important. That's one of the reasons. Actually, we go to Mars to understand Earth rather than going to Mars to understand Mars.
I mean, you mentioned the landing, which in itself was an amazing achievement, and the fact that everything's working and it's moving around. So in a way, was that one of the main aims of this mission, to see if this is possible and how much further you can go with the mechanics of rovers?
Well, obviously we wanted to land, and this was a whole new landing system. And what was interesting about this was that in previous missions have used airbags, where the landing ellipse, the area that you can land in, predict to land in, is very, very large. And with this new landing system, where the rover was basically lowered down onto the surface of Mars on a series of nylon tethers, what they call the sky crane, we could make a much smaller landing ellipse, so we could land in geologically interesting places. And so, you know, that was amazing because it enabled us to do exciting new science. And, you know, one of the reasons to go to Mars and spend all this money is to do exciting new science.
And you're a geologist, and it seems like geologists are really driving force behind this mission. Are the scientists involved mainly geologists, or are there other scientists involved as well?
No, it's a huge group of scientists from all sorts of different fields. So you have geochemists, a variety of different geochemists, you have petrologists, and you have field geologists like myself. And it's sort of like combining all the different subjects. We have weather experts, we have radiation experts, because there's a whole series of instruments on the rover. But the primary objective for the mission is to identify sites on Mars at this location where there's potential to find evidence for ancient life. Now, it's not looking for life. It's about a word called habitability. It's about whether there were rocks or environments on Mars that had the potential to have life form in and, you know, flourish in, and then be preserved in. And it's the first step towards the big goal of discovering life.
And how far along on those steps have you got so far?
Well, I think we've been really remarkably successful, actually. Firstly, we're working the mission, everything's working well, all the instruments are working well. But, you know, planetary missions are a little bit of serendipity. We don't have a map when we land. Well, we sort of have a map. We have images, orbital images, and we did a little crowdsourcing exercise within the team, and we all mapped different quads in traditional geological fashion. But obviously, we can't touch those rocks, so their interpretation in some ways. But we use those as guidelines, and what we've been doing is exploring. So actually, very quickly into the mission, we discovered that there were actually rocks near the surface, very thin-bedded rocks. And the most exciting discovery was that we discovered those rocks contained pebbles that were cemented. And these pebbles were quite large. up to several centimetres in diameter, and they had round perimeters. So it told us that they were transported by some sort of flow, and it had to be a water flow because this couldn't be transported by air.
And we hear a lot of news stories about water on Mars, and there seems to be a breaking story about water on Mars quite often. What would it take for us to be completely sure of this, or are we're completely sure of this already?
So I think this discovery of the pebbles is really the big change, because what it tells us is that the previous stories of water on Mars come from orbital observations, so remote sensing, and we see canyons, we see channels, but there's still arguments. You know, some people argue that these canyons were cut by lava flows, for example. What we found is rocks that are sedimentary rocks. The pebbles tell us that they've been transported and they've hit each other and become rounded through time. And that's very difficult to do by any other process apart from water for their size. It requires turbulent flow. So it's actually the sedimentary rock evidence that's the nail in the coffin in some ways.
And this is based on your experience as a sedimentologist. As someone who's an expert on Earth geology, what's it like to go to a completely new planet? Are there similar...
Yeah, it's really funny actually, because we looked at these images and we thought initially and we thought, oh yeah, pebbles in a bed, and kind of, okay, great. Yeah. And it took us a few days to actually realise, gosh, this is pretty amazing.
And the pictures you showed could have been from Earth.
Yeah, and then amazing. I remember talking to a friend of mine who sent me an email, a really close friend of mine, sent me an email and said he couldn't believe how boring these images were, because he said they look like all these boring conglomerates. I mean, he actually works in conglomerates, so they're not really boring, but they look like all these boring conglomerates he's been studying for 30 years. And that's actually the amazing thing, is that they're so familiar, and you have to take a step back and think, gosh, this is actually on another planet. And so the same physics works, and the same processes have operated. And that's wonderful, because actually, if it was something truly outlandish, we wouldn't be able to interpret it, because we wouldn't have something to go on. Because it's so boring in some ways, because it's so familiar, we can actually make sense of it, and we can actually produce quite a high level interpretation of these features.
And it's very familiar, yet obviously not familiar in many other ways. What do we know what happened on Mars to change it so much compared to what happened to Earth?
No, that's the evolving story. That's the exploration. So we're just beginning to fit those pieces together. So it's the start. We can't solve every problem, but we're going to build a picture. We see sedimentary rocks. We're trying to look at the rock succession, just as a geologist on Earth would do. We find mudstones that we think were deposited in an ancient playa or a lake. They contain clay minerals. So we have this ancient environment that we've reconstructed, and you know, it's a watery environment. So it's the first time that a rover has reconstructed an ancient watery environment, and that's really great, because it's the first habitable environment. And so it gives us great confidence for the future. And the other thing that's really exciting is that we see a huge diversity. It's not simple. In fact, as one person on our team said, this isn't the model planet anymore. This is a real planet with all its nooks and crannies and complexities. So Mars has suddenly become complex. And that means that it's a good place to explore, because there's a lot of diversity and lots of different things to explore. It's not a simple place.
You talked a bit about the fact that you don't have maps. Obviously, this is, in a way, this is the mapping. How much can you plan a mission like this? How much was there a plan for where you were going to go and what you were going to look at? Or how much is it based on what you see when you get there?
So, of course, there's a plan. It's chosen through a whole very competitive process. You know, nobody's going to spend that much money. It hasn't been, but what we do is we use orbital images. So we use satellite images to map. And actually, you know, some of the satellite images from Mars are amazing. We can see, we can look at 25 centimeters per pixel. The images are extraordinary. We can see boulders that are a couple of meters in diameter. But that's the surface. And we can see rock layers. But for geologists, and particularly sedimentary geologists, we have to actually look at features in the rocks to confirm them. So it's a step in the science. It's not the science does it in one step. We have a process. And so we had ideas of what these things might be, hypotheses, conjectures, and we're going that next step in really solving that. And you know, I think for some of the features that we've looked at now, we've actually resolved this. We can really quite categorically say that these conglomerates, these lithified pebbly sandstones, must have been transported by ancient rivers. It's very difficult to explain that by other mechanisms. So it's fine-tuning the model, and that's what you need to do. The science is always about fine-tuning the models.
So last time we heard from the project was when John Grotzinger spoke to us about the process of selection that was gone through to choose this landing site. What was the reason in the end for picking that one over so many other candidates?
So we had lots of candidate sites and they finally picked four. And in fact, I was working on another one, another site called Eberswalde, which is supposed to be an ancient delta that was in the top competition. It's quite scary having the site you're working on with other people being in the competition. The reason they chose Gale Crater was actually something really fundamental to geology. In the early days of geology, what people did was that they measured vertical sections, because vertical sections, sedimentary sections, give you time. And so here we had a mountain in the center of Gale Crater with 5 kilometers high, 5 kilometers of probable sedimentary rocks, layered stratified rocks. And by basically climbing up this mountain, we could go from some of these oldest rocks formed just shortly after Gale Crater formed to much younger rocks. The other reason was that we also knew from orbital observations, spectrometers on board some of these orbiters, that the lowermost parts of the Gale Mound, the mountain, contain clay minerals from remote sensing, have a signature of clay minerals, and then this, we see a transition to sulfate minerals, and then the sulfate minerals disappear.
So can find this out without even having...
Yeah, so it's not in situ measurement, but it's an orbital detection. And what we want to do is, what's very exciting is that clay minerals and sulfate minerals are hydrated minerals. So again, they're telling us something about the watery past. And we want to understand that. Is it surface water that's formed these minerals? Is it diagenetic? So that's later flow of water that's precipitated minerals in these rocks, and again reconstruct in fine detail that. So that was the other reason, because we could see strong signatures of these mineral types and we could see a transition. And so what we would actually able to see is obviously clay minerals require a lot of water, sulfate minerals less water to form in. So is there a geochemical transition in the history of Gale Crater? And can we relate this to the climatic history of Mars? So that climatic history, is locked in the rock record. That's our archive. The rock record is our archive. And, you know, this is the first time that a rover is going to look at a long stratigraphic section to reconstruct it. And that's why Gale was chosen for that reason.
And Curiosity's been going for just over a year now. Is there a projected end point? Do you know how much longer it's got in its legs?
So obviously there's a mission timeline. The mission timeline was 2 Mars years, I believe. But, you know, it's powered by a plutonium battery power source. So it could go on for many, many years. And so power is not an issue. It's really going to be instrument wear and tear, but all is going well. We tend to treat each day as it comes, because that means you maximize the science. So we work every day and we try and maximize the science every day. We don't waste time, we don't waddle around. We certainly don't do what I do in the field, when I'm in the field and sit around and drink a lot of coffee and speculate about things.
Doesn't have to go for a beer, yeah.
So yeah, we work really hard and the science team works really hard at maximizing the science, because you know, there's this amazing science to discover and all these new exciting things to find.
Well, thank you very much. You're doing the lecture all over again in about an hour's time, so I'll leave you there. Professor Sanjeev Gupta, thanks very much for talking to me.
Thank you very much.